Hello, this is Cedaring Fox with a few words about this rebroadcast. First of all, please note that Word Theater holds the copyright to these recordings, and no portion of anything you hear may be reproduced without permission. We kicked off this podcast on January 24th, 2021, and since then we have shared 160 episodes with you for free. Word Theater is a nonprofit organization in the US and a charitable organization in the UK. We are a completely non-commercial enterprise, offering you the finest writing delivered in world-class performances. And we are commercial-free. We don't do it for advertising revenue. We do it for one reason only, because we are on a mission to connect people across the globe to make a better world by sharing stories of what it is to be human. We all have so much more in common than we have differences. We simply ask you to step into these stories, walk for a time in the shoes of the characters you meet, and allow yourself to live in their skins, feel their feelings, empathize with their struggles, celebrate their joys, and always feel compassion for others. When we launched our weekly podcast back in 2021, for the first several weeks, we shared recordings of live performances of stories by the one and only California-based master of the genre, T.C. Boyle. In the course of our 20-plus years performing short stories in L.A., New York, London, and across England, Tom has been a frequent contributor to Word Theater, and he loves what we do here. On June 9th, 2024, we will have a private lunch party in Los Angeles for Word Theater patron and enthusiast members and their friends. We'll have tacos, margaritas, and T.C. Boyle performing one of his most brilliant stories alongside Christina Pickles. If you didn't know, Christina played Jennifer Aniston's mom on Friends and Leonardo DiCaprio's mom in the film Romeo and Juliet, among her zillions of other credits. In the lead-up to our members' party, we will be rebroadcasting these marvelous T.C. Boyle episodes from our archive, one each week. We truly hope you'll join us as a contributing member. There are always groovy perks of membership. Another example, you can view recordings of nearly all our live events on your private members' page within a few weeks of the live performance. Yes, wherever you live, you can experience the wonderful work that we do. So, if you help support this podcast, we can keep it as a purely non-commercial enterprise. Just visit wordtheater.org/membership. We have a few thank yous that will not be on the end credits since this is a rebroadcast, so here goes. Special thanks to philanthropist and benefactor Ola Strome. Thank you to Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture for their continuing support. To our podcast editor, Jason Lee. To all our wonderful interns. And to our executive coordinator, Scout Riley. Enjoy. We are kicking off the Word Theater podcast with 6 weeks of stories by an absolute master of the genre, T.C. Boyle. With at least 28 books to his name, this American-born novelist and short story writer is, quite simply, a star. His short stories are imbued with wit, daring, and his signature zeal for storytelling, making them pure joy to perform at Word Theater. Technically ingenious, mordantly funny, poignant, and often startling. T.C. Boyle's short stories waltz effortlessly between comedy and tragedy with a kind of gleeful mania. Today's offering is a prime example. But first, let's hear from our author.
When I first moved to Los Angeles many years ago, I discovered a little sanctuary high in the mountains of the Sequoia National Forest, and I've spent a lot of time there since. This story, My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain, is set amongst them, people who call the rest of us flatlanders. It's a story of obsessive love, and like most such stories, it is a comedy. I happen to be present for the recording of My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain at a small club in Los Angeles when Jeff Goldblum gave us his take on it. He brought the house down.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is Jeff Goldblum performing My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain by T.C. Boyle.
I like my wife fine. We had a pretty smooth run of it over the years. But there was a sort of expectedness to the days, but sometimes bore down on me till I felt like a piece of furniture that hasn't been moved in a lifetime. An end table, maybe, made of maple with some fine beveling that serves no other purpose than to collect dust, which is why, and I'm not making excuses, just stating the facts, I pulled on my black jeans and turtleneck that night, dug my ski mask out of the closet, and climbed up the backside of Lily Barron's cabin to the patch of roof where the deck projects on the second floor, and peeped in the window with no other intention but to see what she was doing at 11:45 at night. And maybe, if that was what she wanted, to surprise her. Give her a little jolt. In the best possible sense, that is, by way of amiability and with the promise of mutual enjoyment. You see, Lily had had it rough this past year. She's only 43. But Frank, her husband, who's no longer with us, was in his 60s. And when he retired, she quit her job as a legal secretary and came up here to Big Timber to live out the rest of her days in tranquility amidst the giant sequoias. They built their dream house on the double lot that Frank had bought back in the 80s and became full-timers, or dream cabin, I should say, since the 28 of us who live here year-round, as well as the 50 or so part-timers, like to think of ourselves as roughing it. And while a couple of us do have actual log cabins built from kits out of actual peeled logs, most of us settle for houses with alpine touches, like cedar paneling, stone fireplaces, and mounted animal heads over our hand-hewn mantelpieces. To a man, woman, child, and dog, we call them cabins. Frank volunteered for Neighborhood Watch, and he helped out in winter with snow removal. And Lily, with her heartbreaking face and a figure unruined by childbearing, because she'd borne no children, not to Frank, or her previous husband, who I understand worked for the Forest Service over at Mineral King, before he drank himself senseless and pitched headlong over the rail of the fire lookout, began organizing potlucks, she did, and bridge nights down at the lodge, that sort of thing. And she began drinking more than probably was good for her. As did Frank. This, and we've all joked about it, is just one of the hazards of living in a fishbowl community at 7,200 feet and a good twisting, break-eating hour from the nearest town in a place of natural beauty so all-encompassing that God might have thought to set it aside for his wife, if he even bothered to get married. Anyway, Frank liked nature. He liked the hills. And despite his age, he was always out there hiking, no matter the weather. You'd look up from the fire or the TV or your first double vodka and tonic on a snow-bleared winter morning, and there he'd be with his day pack and alpenstock heading off into the woods without a thought as to trails, compasses, or the weather. And if he had a cell phone, it really wouldn't have mattered, since the reception here is what they invented the call failed indicator for. He went out one spring afternoon with his fly rod and a day pack containing a pint of Jim Beam and two cream cheese and olive sandwiches that Lily had wrapped neatly in plastic wrap. And he never came back. As they later reconstructed it, he was fishing Hellborn Creek for goldens when he must have taken a tumble because his leg was broken in two places though with his eyes gouged out by the ravens, and the way the bear had frolicked with the corpse. Nobody could be sure. He'd been missing 4 days by the time search and rescue found him. The sandwich is gone, along with the soft stuff of his eyes, and the bourbon drawn down to less than a finger in its intact glass shell. Lily said she was sure that he'd suffered. We all tried to reassure her, no, citing the solace of the bourbon. The soothing rhapsody of the stream, and the sun that made way for the stars as if to give him a glimpse of eternity when the nights came on. But privately, we knew she was right. Of course he'd suffered, alone, with his pain, hopeless, fighting off the ravens, till he could no longer lift his arms. He'd tried to crawl his way out of the canyon, according to Bill Secord, who was one of the first on the scene. But the pain in his leg was too bad, apparently, and he didn't make it more than maybe 200 yards, despite all the scratching and the undergrowth and the way his fingernails were abraded down to the nub. As if that wasn't enough to lay on any woman, especially one as sweet and undeserving of it as Lily, there was the further complication of her accident. And this wasn't much more than maybe 3 or 4 months after the funeral, when she was just starting to climb out of her own personal canyon and was entertaining a man whose name I don't want to mention here, because the sound of that name, hell, the look of him with his fat, gloating face hanging out the open window of his pickup makes me burn up with jealousy like a dry stick of pine laid on the coals. Oh, that's funny, too. I mean that this particular image should pop into my head because Lily's accident involved just exactly that, burning. She had one of these old-fashioned popcorn makers with hot oil bubbling in the guts of it. And the way I see it, she was a bit flustered when this particular individual showed up at the door with a bottle in one hand and a fistful of wilting wildflowers in the other. No way ready even to start thinking along those terms with Frank still intact in the ground, or mostly so. And maybe she was rushing a little, overcompensating in her role as hostess, and when she settled into the couch with her second drink, her foot got tangled in the cord, and the whole business, the scalding oil, Orville Redenbacher's crackling yellow kernels, and the gleaming aluminum cylinder of the popcorn maker itself came down on her. The oil melted the skin across half her back down to the panty line and wrapped a big annealed scar around her left shoulder and upper arm and burned what looked like 2 teardrops in the flesh under her left eye, which the plastic surgeon says he can remove and smooth over just like new once she saves up for the next round of operations, because of course Frank, who never even bothered to carry a compass with him out into the doom-haunted woods, didn't have adequate health coverage from his insurer, or life insurance, for that matter. I remember we all chipped in to defray the funeral expenses, but inevitably we fell short, well short, of the actual cost, which Lily had to absorb with no help from anybody, not Frank's sister in Missoula, or his one-armed son that Lily had had to put up with through her first 10 years of that marriage. So, I was on her roof. With cause. And Jessica, my wife, who likes to turn in early, she's yawning and gaping and stretching her arms like out she's drowning, come 7:30 or 8, was at home, oblivious, snoring lightly, in the frigid cavern of the bedroom that we shared, with its view in summer of the blistered duff at the ankles of the trees, and in winter the piled-up drifts that look like waves rolling across a stormy white sea. If I'd expected Lily to be, oh, I don't know, putting her hair up before the bathroom mirror so that her breasts rose and fell with the action of her arms in a baby blue see-through negligee or something of the like, I was disappointed. At first, I could see nothing but the upper hallway leading to her bedroom and the head of that mounted mule deer that graced the top of the stairway, the rock-hard nose of which I'd kissed for luck any number of times when Jessica and I were over for drinks and dinner and drinks when Frank was alive. There was a light on there, glowing faintly in the cheap smoked glass sconce that they got for $12.95 at the Home Depot in Porterville. But there was no sign of any movement. Or of her. They had a dog. She had a dog, I should say. A Chihuahua mix. But it was so old and withered and blind and deaf and pathetic, it couldn't have raised the alarm if an entire armored division rolled through the living room. So I waited and watched. Did I mention, by the way, that this was in winter? The night was clear all the way up to where the stars slid across their tracks, which meant that it was cold, maybe 10 or 12 above. And I was having a little trouble seeing through the eye slits of my mask. Plus, my breath was condensing around the opening for my mouth and freezing there so that my lips had begun to sting even before I'd got to Lily's on foot, because I didn't want to just pull up out there out front in my truck, because that would have spoiled the surprise. That, you never knew who was watching up here, where everybody's business is everybody's business. At least the roof was clear. Frank had gone metal with a steep pitch that overhung the upper deck, and the sun had taken the 3 feet of snow that the last storm had dropped and deposited it down below. All to the good. I broke the crust of ice around my mouth and was just about to ease myself down on the deck to get a good look in the window there, the bedroom window, when the slick, thin, all but invisible sheet of ice that had replaced the snow took my boots out from under me and I lost my balance. We don't have gutters here, for obvious reasons. The weight of the snow shearing over the side would rip them off in a heartbeat. So there was nothing between me and a two-story drop but corrugated sheet metal and the odd rivet. I was a little drunk. I admit it. We'd been over to the Ringsteads for drinks and cards earlier, and after we got home, I guess I kept on pouring, even as I was thinking about how lonely Lily must have been, because half the mountain was there, but she never showed. Anyway, I did not plummet over the side and go down two stories to where the big granite boulders protruded like bagged teeth from the drifts. Or not yet, anyway. But instead just managed to catch myself on one of the steel chimney supports that Frank had been obliged to install after a Jeffrey Pine came down and obliterated the chimney last winter. I was spared. But the noise that I'd made in trying to save myself got the blind and deaf Chihuahua barking. And that barking apparently roused Lily. I was spread-eagled on the slick roof and just trying to inch my way across to the deck when the door there flew open and Lily appeared, dressed in the baby blue nightie of my dreams. Which I guess I must have seen hanging on the hook in the bathroom when I went in to relieve myself on one of those happy dinner drinks nights. Only with a big off-white cable-knit sweater obscuring the parts of her anatomy that I'd most come to see. She let out a low exclamation in her sweet, girlish voice that was like the trickle of a pure mountain spring. The dog at her feet yapping, and the weight of all those stars beginning to crash down on me. And then she said, Don't you move, you son of a bitch, because I've got a gun. And she did have a gun. We all have guns up here. 20 guns per person. As if it were a rule of the community. Of course, I didn't have one, or not then, anyway. My 20 guns were back home in my own cabin. But here was my problem. I'd come to reconnoiter, albeit with the hope and maybe even expectation of a whole lot more. But I'd lost the element of surprise. And I wondered now whether I ought to say something to identify myself as me, and not some crazed rapist paroled out of Lompoc prison and dressed all in black with a black ski mask concealing his face and bad intentions in his heart. And it wasn't getting shot that motivated me, believe me, because I would have welcomed it at that point. It was what my mother, my poor, dead, overworked, and long-suffering mother used to call mortification. If I revealed myself now that she'd got the drop on me, as they say, how could I hope to convince her that my purpose was essentially romantic? And beyond that, consolatory even? As it turned out, that decision was taken from my hands by the action of what some people would call fate. But that I'm here to tell you was just bad luck. Pure and simple. I lost my grip. The roof was like a skating rink, if you could take a skating rink and cant it at a 45-degree angle. Suddenly, the night deserted me, and I was gone. And it was my bad luck, my very bad, catastrophic luck, that I did not land amongst the drifts, but on a big, unforgiving incisor of rock that broke my leg just as thoroughly and nastily as Frank's had been broken out there among the boulders of Hellbourne Creek. Ah. While I was lying there, concealed behind my mask like a second-string superhero, and unable to move because the pain was like a comet trapped inside my body, I began thinking, and I don't know why, of the stepson of Frank Jr. He'd lost his arm in an incident at the San Diego Zoo when he was 14. Which you may have read about, because it made all the papers at the time. There was still a controversy surrounding the whole business as to whether he really was high on angel dust and provoking the polar bear, where it was only trying to cool off in its fetid little pond of greenish water, or whether he honestly slipped and fell. But the result was that he lost his right arm right to the shoulder and maybe a little beyond. You look at him now, he's 32 years old, handsome as a TV anchor man, with Frank's blonde hair and squared-off features, and from the left side, he could be doing Marine Corps recruiting posters. But on the right, there's just nothing there. And when he walks, it really throws him off balance, so he's got a kind of funny hitch in his step. Lily, who's just 11 years older than he is, more the age of a big sister than a mother, had to put up with him under her roof when she and Frank lived down in the flats all those years because with his disability, Frank Jr. couldn't support himself. And believe me, he's about as pleasant to be around as a cage full of rats, angry at the world, always pissing and moaning about the indescribable pain that he feels in his missing limb, which he invariably goes on to describe in detail ad nauseum. But let me get back to it, because this connects into what I'm trying to say here about pain, about my pain, and Lily's pain, and everybody else's too. The upshot being that about 3 minutes later, I'm exposed for who I am to Lily, who's standing over me with a flashlight and her snub-nosed 38 special that Frank gave her for her birthday year before last. Because here's the kid, Frank Jr., who's supposed to be living down the hill in Porterville in some sort of halfway house, appearing out of nowhere to swoop down with the one hand that he's got left to him and tear the mask off my face. I don't think I ever talked and wheedled and apologized and extenuated as much as I did that night, stretched out on my back in the snow, and freezing my ass off, while Lily looked at me as if I were something that she'd stepped on in the parking lot at Costco, and Frank Jr. ran in to phone for the sheriff and the fire department and every last living soul on the mountain, including old Brick Sternright, who'd won the title of Mountain Man 3 times running during the Memorial Day chili cook-off, despite the fact that he was closing in on 90. Bart Bliss, who ran the lodge and sported the longest beard on the mountain. 3 widows, 2 widowers, and my own sharp-honed, steel-eyed rapier of a wife, Jessica. There was an interval there, Frank Jr. in the house and phones ringing everywhere, when it was just me and Lily and the dead cold of the night. Lily had lowered the .38, thumbed the safety, and dropped the thing in the pocket of the big cardigan sweater, which I now saw was decorated with a pair of prancing reindeer, done up in red stitching. But the flashlight was still leveled on my face. "Lily," I gasped, fighting for breath against the pain, "could you lower that light, please? Because my leg's broke." I almost said just like Frank's, but suppressed it. "And I can't move, and the light is right in my eyes. Ow." The beam never wavered. "What in the hell were you thinking?" This was framed in an accusatory tone. And her voice was anything but melodious and sweet. "I love you," I said. "I've loved you since the day Frank brought you up here. And we all got drunk on pitchers of margaritas down at the lodge, you remember?" Her voice was flat. "You don't love me." "I do." "You have a funny way of showing it. What'd you think, you'd see me naked or something?" There was the sound in the distance of snow tires crunching the crust of ice on the blacktop road that twisted below us past the Turner's place. And already the headlights were dancing in the tops of the stripped aspens out front of Lily's. You must think I'm like a peeping Tom or something, but really, I mean, no, she said, cutting me off. "I don't think you're a peeping Tom. I think you're a slime. I mean, really, how could you? With Frank barely cold in the ground. And what about Jessica? What about her? What about your wife?" The pain. The comet that was shooting from my lower leg to my brain and back again, fighting to explode into the night. Seized me up in a minute, and I had no reasonable answer to give her. I wanted to say, "She won't mind." Or, "She doesn't have to know." Or, "I don't love her, I love you." But I couldn't. And the mask. What's with the mask? I mean, that's just sick. And so I wheedled and I protested. But it did no good because those tires and those lights belonged to Bill Secord, first responder. And before I could blink twice, the whole community was gathered there to contemplate me and my sprawled and broken disgrace. Ooh, wildly, it came to me that I could say I was just checking the chimney braces as a favor to Frank, in memory of Frank, that is, and to help out a poor widow who didn't know the first thing about winter maintenance. Voices drifted over me. 2 dogs slunk up to sniff my boots. Ooh, I noticed a bottle of vodka passing from hand to hand. No one thought to offer me any. Not even to wet my lips. People debated whether or not I should be moved, and Bill was all official about back injuries and the like, and the sheriff appeared out of the shadows to take his report, while the ambulance was jerking its lights in and out of the trees, and Jessica, my bedmate, my companion, my old rug and sweet married bride, lurched up and leaned over me with her face so disarranged with hurt and confusion and rage that I barely recognized her. As she let loose with a cold wad of spit that wound up freezing right there on my cheek. as the paramedics lifted me onto the stretcher and the doors of the ambulance slammed shut on the night and the mountain, which until that very moment had been my home and my hideout and my refuge from the bad old world. You want pain? Jessica filed for divorce before they even got the pin in my leg. And when I had to rely on that jerk, whose name I won't mention, to drive me home from the hospital and help me up the steps of my own house and then make a second trip out to the car for the wheelchair, she was gone. As was about 87% of the furniture. And the plasma TV that had been my only solace the last couple of years. That and the squirrels, that is. And she cleaned out most of the microwave dinners. And canned goods, so that I had nothing to eat on top of nothing to watch. Oh, that was a cold house. And I tell you, for the rest of that winter, I never showed my face for the humiliation of what had gone down. And if I drank bourbon, I drank it alone. If we're anything, though, we're a community that forgets, if not forgives. Hell, half of them up here have done things twice as bad as looking in on a woman out of concern and love in the dead of a winter's night. And by spring, I was feeling almost back to normal. So much so that I even took the wheelchair down to the lodge one night, up and down those looping, murderous hills for a good mile till my palms were bleeding, and sat there over a medium-rare steak, a pitcher of Firestone, and a shot glass that never stayed dry for long because everybody who came through the door stood me around and slapped me on the back and said how good it was to see me out and about. And that was fine. Time heals all wounds and such, except that my nerves were like guitar strings, twisted too tight, and my heart was undergoing cardiac arrest at the thought that Lily might walk through that door at any minute, which she didn't. I tried calling her when I got back home. Bill Secor gave me a ride, thank God, or I'd probably still be down there. But she had caller ID and wouldn't pick up. Must have been a few weeks later that I ran into that kid out on Tamarack Lane. Tamarack intersects my street, Aspen, and then swerves past our little man-made lake and continues onto the lodge and the main road beyond, so that if I want to go anywhere at all, 90% of the time, it's going to be down Tamarack. We only have a couple of roads up here anyway, snaking, wide, frost-buckled blacktop thoroughfares to nowhere, hemmed in by the towering sequoias and ponderosa pines and the like that give the place its name, with maybe a cabin tucked back in the woods every couple of hundred yards, and these roads loop back around back on themselves, so the plan of the development is like a big hamster maze, one way in, one way out. Beyond that, there's the state route winding its way down to Porterville to the north, in case anybody would want to go down there and buy a plasma TV to replace the one lost to them. And to Kernville on the other side, where there's nothing much but a couple of rundown bars and trinket shops for the tourists. In winter, the Kernville Road is closed due to the fact that nobody lives out there, and the snow, which averages 24 feet per annum and goes to as much as 40 and more in an El Nino year, isn't worth the expense of plowing, which puts us, for a good 4 or 5 months of the year, at the end of the road. For all that indicates or implies about the quality of people that we sometimes, unfortunately, wind up with. This kid was one of them, though I didn't know it at the time. I was getting around pretty good by then with my cane, my legs still shrunken and white as a grub where the cast had constricted it, and I just turned onto Tamarack, thinking to hobble down to the lodge for a little exercise, maybe check the mail, see who was around, have a drink or two, get social, when there he was, striding along in this jaunty, hey, look at me kind of way. Now, it was pretty rare to see strangers walking around the development. Somebody goes by my house, and 9 out of 10, I can tell you their first, middle, and last name, and all the regrets they've had since they got out of elementary school. But there are hikers, and day trippers, and whatnot come by occasionally, so it wasn't unheard of. Anyway, the kid looks to be 20 or so, and he's tall and greyhound skinny, with a little patch of soul beard just like mine. And so, of course, I'm neighborly and call out my standard greeting. What up? which he returns with a big doggy smile that shows off the gap where three of his teeth are missing in front, one upstairs, two down. Next thing, we're standing there chatting, and if I was vaguely aware of one of the house alarms going off up the street, we're always getting cabins broken into up here because you leave a place vacant long enough, somebody's going to notice. I barely gave it a thought. He was pretty winning, this kid, a real talker. Within 60 seconds, he was asking me about the quality of construction up on the mountain. He was a big aficionado of cabin architecture, as well as being a master carpenter, or so he said, and why not believe him? And 3 minutes later, I found myself humping back up Aspen with him to show off what I'd done vis-a-vis layout, exposed beams, roof pitch, and all the rest when I took early retirement and built the place for Jessica 6 years ago. We got talking. I made a pot of coffee. He leaned back in the one armchair that my wife had left behind and observed that the place was pretty spare. I agreed that it was, and I said to myself, what the hell, what have I got to lose? So I told him my story. And when I was done, I have to admit, I went to some length to wring out the very bitterest dregs out of it. I offered to freshen up his coffee with a shot of Jim Beam. And he took me up on it. And then, because we were just being neighborly as all hell, and maybe I hadn't had as many people to talk to as I might have liked these past months, I encouraged him to sit right there and open up. What was his story? How'd he wind up on the mountain? Was he somebody's kid, grandkid? Let me tell you, if you thought Lily had troubles, this kid went her one better or worse, I guess. He just looked at me a long moment over the rim of his cup, as if deciding whether to trust me or not, and he never flinched when the sheriff's four-by went up and down the road two, if not three times, sirens screaming. And then he said, you ever hear about that kid that the parolee snatched in the back of Safeway when he was 9 years old, and then kept him traveling around the country till the kid didn't know where he was or even who he was? Not to mention the dirty things that he made that scared little kid do just to earn a candy bar or shit, a half-rotten scrap of meat. The handcuffs? You hear about the handcuffs? That was a story. How he had to eat dog food out of the can. With the only present the man ever gave him, which was a bent spoon. How the man made him split wood for the stove and clean the house like a slave all day. Wouldn't let him get within a mile of a newspaper. Never let him out of the house. Didn't even have a TV. I still don't know how much of it was the truth, but I watched the tears come up in his eyes. And you know he had trouble, whatever it was. We sat there talking for the better part of an hour. And then the sheriff, siren stifled now, but his lights still flashing, pulled into the driveway. And who was with him but Bill Secord, stepping out carefully so as not to trample the irises that Jessica planted along the drive last year. And right behind him, in her red cowgirl boots and skin-tight jeans, was Lily. The kid gave me a look. I need to tell you something. He started, and I cut him off. You've been breaking into cabins? Not really. What do you mean, not really? Either you did or you didn't. There was the thump of the sheriff's footfall on the weathered cedar planks of the front deck, and then the accompanying thump of Bill's boot, and a lighter tread altogether, which was Lily's, I knew. Can I tell you that I was torn in two directions in that instant? That I felt something for the kid, despite myself, and that the thought of seeing Lily's pale white oval face and maybe a catching a whiff of that $125 an ounce perfume that she dabbed so prettily under the twin points of her jawbone had me all but paralyzed. The kid's voice came at me like a tape on high speed. Listen, I didn't steal anything. I mean, look at me. Where would I hide it? I was hungry, that was all, because it wasn't normal what happened to me, you know, and I'm sorry, I just get these food cravings. He was on his feet now, and he was pleading. I only escaped 3 years ago. I didn't say anything. Lily was right outside the door. Listen, I'm begging you, the kid said, drifting like a shadow across the room. I just want to, could I just go in the bedroom a minute and close the door? And so he did. and I opened the front door to the sheriff. His name is Randy Juniper. He's 36 years old, and he has a permanent hair up his ass, which is to say, I don't like him. Never have liked him, never will. Bill Secord. And Lily. Lily looked like she was drowning. Water up to her neck and the river in flood. She and Bill stepped in the room, and Bill closed the door behind him and stared down at his shoes. Randy, I noticed, had his 3-foot-long flashlight in one hand, though it was broad daylight, and he squinted at me in my own living room as if it was an interrogation cell in Guantanamo or someplace. And then, in his official sheriffese, he said, "You see anybody suspicious out there this morning?"
"They broke into my cabin,"
Lily whispered, not looking at me.
"Who?"
I said, playing for time. Now she did glance up. Her eyes, which are the exact color of Coca-Cola, poured into a clear, spotless glass. Hardening with the contemplation of how much had been laid on her and laid on her again, "This kid," she said, her voice gone soft, "like a teenager, or maybe 20s, real gawky and skinny and stupid looking. I pulled into the drive because I was down the lodge for breakfast, and I saw him coming around the back of the cabin, and when he saw me, he just took off into the woods." Next question, and I didn't like the way Sheriff Randy was looking at me, not at all. "Did they get anything?" They hadn't, but the screen over the kitchen sink had been slid open, and that was enough for her and the sheriff. "You," the sheriff said finally, "wouldn't know anything about it, would you?" My answer was a long time coming. Seconds, I guess 5, maybe 10 even. I didn't like the implication here, because what they were hinting at was that I was a criminal. A thief, maybe a colluder with thieves, and all because I fell off Lily's roof with the best of intentions, with love in my heart. And so I just looked Randy right in the face, and I shook my head no. Time passes slowly up here. The hours squeezing out like toothpaste at the flattened end of the tube. I noticed that the days got a little longer, and then they started to get a little shorter. The sun hung up in the trees. I fed the birds and the squirrels and stared at the faded place on the wall where the TV had been and thought about various projects that I might embark on to fill the lonely hours. Building a chicken coop, maybe? Though chickens wouldn't last half an hour up here, what with the coyotes and the bear and his cousins. Buying a horse or a dirt bike so that I could get out in the woods more. Overhauling the engine on my snow machine. None of these came to fruition. And if I'd taken some satisfaction in how much my neighbors drank, half of them with corrupted livers, and at least 2 I know working on a single kidney each, now I was drinking so heavily that I found myself waking up all day long and in places I didn't even know I could get to, like on top of the refrigerator, or underneath the pickup. Lily was the problem, of course. And Jessica, who'd moved in with her mother in Sacramento and refused to return my calls. I did give Jessica some thought, remembering the good times, like when I held her head down for a full 110 seconds during an apple bobbing contest at the county fair. Or how we'd make up a big pot of chili beans and sit out on the deck and listen to the sounds of nature. But it was Lily who occupied my thoughts. My leg was getting stronger, and more I found myself drifting past her cabin on my daily walks or driving by after dark just to see if her lights were on. One day, late afternoon, September touching the leaves of the aspens, so they went from green to gold overnight, and the breath of winter impatient on the air. I just couldn't take it any longer, and I decided to dig out my bird-watching binoculars and maybe just stroll through the woods a bit. And if I wound up on the ridge across from Lily's with an unobstructed view of the lower deck and the Weber grill giving off smoke in the corner there, so much the worse. No one was in sight, but the smoke told me that Lily was barbecuing. The thought of that. Not just the way she did tri-tip. With her special sauce that managed to be both sweet and sour in equal proportions. And how she leaned over you to refresh your drink so that you could smell the bourbon on her breath and her perfume at the same time. But the sad fact that I'd once shuffled across the boards of that very deck as an honored guest got me feeling nostalgic. I sat there on a hard lump of rock, the binoculars trained on the windows. Nostalgia clogging my veins like sludge, till the sun shifted and shadows tipped back from the trees, and Lily finally appeared. A platter of meat in one hand, and a spatula and tongs in the other. She was wearing a pair of red shorts that emphasized the creases front and rear, and a low-cut white blouse. Her feet were bare. Oh, I wanted to kiss those feet. I wanted to come down off my perch and worry over the splinters that were certainly a danger on that deck that hadn't been treated since Frank had died. Wanted to warn her, make a joke, see her smile. We all have binoculars up here, by the way, which are necessary to the enjoyment of nature, or so we tell ourselves. And we like to compete as to who's the most powerful, just as we compete over our 4x4s, snow machines, and the like. Jessica got my good ones, the Bushnell Elites that allow you to count the whiskers on her marmot's snout half a mile away. But the ones she left me, bargain basement Nikon 7x20s, were more than adequate to the purpose. I could see not only that Lily had had her toenails done in a shade of red that came as close to the hue of those clinging shorts as was humanly possible. Both of her big toes sported a little white rose painted right in the middle. She was wearing her hoop earrings, the silver glinting in the long tube of sunlight as she bent to lift the top off the Weber and employ the tongs. And though I was maybe a football field away, it was close enough to hear the first startled sizzle of the meat hitting the grill. Or maybe I was just imagining that. But I could see that she was all made up, beautiful as a porcelain doll, with her eyebrows penciled in and her lashes thick as fur. So I'm only human. And what I was thinking was that even if she wasn't ready for my company, even if she wouldn't glance up when I mounted the steps to the deck with a sad, forgiving smile and invite me to sit down and break bread with her, or in this case, slice tri-tip, she would at least have to acknowledge me and maybe even hear me out on the subject of the ski mask and the roof and all the rest, because I loved her purely. And I wanted her to know that. As if it had been decided all along, I pushed myself up from the rock just like that and kept to the cover of the trees while she fussed around the little picnic table on the deck. And as I got closer, I could hear the strains of some 80s band leaching out through the screen door in the front. At the foot of the driveway, I bent to secrete the binoculars under a bush so as not to give her the wrong impression. And then I came silently up on her, looking to the surprise factor, though I wasn't yet sure if I was going to chime out, guess who? Or just hi, and add that I was in the neighborhood. It was a joke, we were all in the neighborhood 24/7. And just thought I'd say hello. As it turned out, I didn't have the opportunity because at that moment, Frank Jr. came backing his way out through the screen door. A big wooden bowl of salad clutched to his chest under the pressure of his arm and the rim of a sloshing cocktail glass clenched between his teeth. When he saw me, I was at the landing of the six steps that led up to the lower deck, he just about spit the glass into the bowl. As it was, he fumbled the bowl awkwardly for half a second before he hit the deck, spewing romaine and cherry tomatoes across the bleached boards, and I was worried that he was going to bite through the glass, but he caught himself. Lily saw me then. Her look was blank at first, as if she didn't recognize me, or more likely couldn't place me in context. So far had she gone in wiping me off her personal slate. Frank Jr. broke the silence. Jesus, you got brass. I couldn't be sure, but Lily looked as if she was smiling at me. Or maybe, considering what happened next, she was grimacing. Honestly, I don't know. Frank Jr. moved across the deck to put himself between me and her as if I was some sort of threat, which I wasn't and never have been. And I couldn't help comparing him with the skinny kid who'd come up here to violate people's space and steal what little they had for his own use. Frank Jr. was older, better looking, but they were both kids to me, and they shared the same general look, a kind of twitching around the mouth that only showed the kind of contempt they had for older people. And in that moment, I half wished I'd turned the kid in. I never did find out what happened to him. They found a stolen Mustang convertible abandoned on one of the logging roads not a mile and a half from the development, but whether he was responsible or not, nobody could say. For my part, I just pushed open the bedroom door after the sheriff left and found the room empty, as if the kid were nothing more than my own invention. Frank Jr. was real enough, though, and he let out a low curse and said neither me or Lily want to see you on this property. Not now or ever. And he turned to her and squeezed her to him. And I saw something there that made my heart jump. Right, Lily? I don't know how it happened, but I found myself all the way up the 6 steps and standing there on the deck as if I belonged. And I started to explain. But that was one of the hardest things I ever had to do in my life because all the factors had been churning around in me through all those washed-out months. So I just said what I'd said to her that night. Lily, I said, I'm sorry if I offended you, or whatever. I paused, and her eyes weren't so much hateful as just stunned. But you know why I did it. She said nothing. Frank Jr. took a step forward. No, he said low and nasty. She doesn't. Because I love her, I said. And maybe I took a step toward him, too, so that we were 3 feet apart. And the next thing I knew, I heard the sound of one fist clapping against my cheekbone. Frank Jr., and he has a lot of power in that arm, because when you think of it, that arm has to do the work of two, lashed out and hit me, and I tell you, it was bad luck, pure and simple, that sent me into the rail that maybe wasn't up to code with regard to height requirements and pitched me right over it into the duff 10 feet down on my leg. My bad leg, which broke all over again with a snap that you could have heard in Sacramento. But that wasn't the worst. The worst was that Lily, instead of coming to my aid, as even an anonymous stranger would have, instead took hold of Frank Jr. with both her strong, shapely, bare, suntanned arms and pulled her to him for a long, soul kiss that left not a single doubt in my mind. And I tell you, he was the stepson. The stepson, for Christ's sake. I mean, morally speaking, isn't that what they call incest? I won't go into detail about Bill Secord and the sheriff and the whole playing out of the same charade of the winter past. But I will say that when you talk about pain, it comes in varieties and dominions that nobody can even begin to imagine. And when you talk about fate, which I reject as a useful proposition, you talk about some kind of wheel that you can never get off of. Fate doesn't leave you any margin for hope or redemption or even change. With fate, the fix is in. But I'm going to tell you that luck is different. Bad luck, anyway. Bad luck can change. I sit here in my rented wheelchair and look out into the trees present and see the ghosts of the trees past and tell myself it has to, because nobody, not Lily with her scarred back and 2 permanent tears, or Frank Jr. with his missing arm, or the snatched kid who had to degrade himself every minute of every day without hope, even with the faintest flicker of love, could stand to be as lonely and miserable as this.
We hope you have enjoyed Jeff Goldblum's reading of My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain. Copyright 2010 by T.C. Boyle. Audio recording used by permission of Blackstone Audio on behalf of the author. Feel free to share it or listen to it again for the next couple of months. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll follow us on social media. Visit us on wordtheater.com where you can pick up Tom's books, sign up for our mailing list, and learn about Word Theater membership, which will get you an invitation to our Zoom interview with Mr. Boyle and some of the actors. Next week, Miguel Sandoval performs T.C. Boyle's Sin Dolor. Special thanks to Jonathan Sachs, who composed our theme music, and to our audio engineer, Joseph Cho. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles.
This is goodbye from Kirsty in England.